This is Fresh Air. Comic David Brenner has been on TV a zillion times. He used to sub for Johnny Carson. Club dates and performances have taken him around the world. We spoke to him during a trip to his hometown, Philadelphia. It was right after the publication of his humor book about travel called If God Wanted Us to Travel. Of course, when David Brenner travels, everyone recognizes him. I asked him if that makes him self-conscious about sleeping on a plane.
What I do is I literally take a blanket and put it over my head, over my face, and I put the Do Not Disturb sign on the blanket, and all they see is what looks like a mummy is there. I cover up my face, yeah, because they see how you sleep. They want to see everything. They want to see how you walk, how you eat an apple. It's true. It's very nice. It's very flattering and all that, and endearing, I guess, but it's annoying. So what I do is I cover my head with a blanket.
Can you sleep that way?
Yeah, because what I put the blanket on my lap, and over my knees, and then I pull it up, and I pull it on my head, and then I put my head back on the seat so it stays attached, and I go to sleep.
Stewardess to say anything?
No, I tell them ahead of time I'm going to do this, because it frightens them. And I'm gonna, and I put the Do Not Disturb on the blanket.
And if you suffocated, they'd be held responsible,
Well, they wouldn't
right?
know it, right? You don't move under there.
Well, a lot of times when I travel, I feel it's like the me festival, because wherever I go, you know, the elevator is mirrored. You're waiting for the elevator. It's mirrored. Your hotel room, there's mirrors there, bathroom, mirrors all over. You just can't get away from your own face.
I think it's even worse for me. I'll tell you why it's worse for me, because if it isn't a mirror, or in addition to the mirror, if I'm working in that particular place, there's a picture of me in the hotel elevator.
Right.
I walk to the lobby, there's a picture of me, and there are mirrors. I get in the hotel elevator, there's a picture of me, and mirrors. I get in a room in the hall, there's a picture of me, and then I get into my room, and then there's a little thing on the desk, and there's something in the bedroom saying I'm there. So I'm constantly surrounded by myself.
How do you deal with it?
I try to ignore myself as best I can.
Let's go back a ways to when you were growing up. Your father had been a comic. I think this might have been before you were born.
Yeah, it was way before I was born.
He was a vaudeville comic. Comedian
and a song and dance man, yeah.
Well, so what kind of material did he do?
If you were to take, my father had a premise, and his premise was, I like to catch the guy. See, like, I like to catch the guy who says get married. I tell him blah, 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 blah. I like to catch the guy who paints houses. I like to catch the guy who fixed my car. I like to catch the guy who made my car and all that kind of stuff. And I didn't take that handle, but one day I realized that if you were to take my material and put in front of my humor, I like to catch the guy, it's applicable to about 90% of my humor. In a sense, I'm not a clone, but I was a student of my father. I loved my father. He was the funniest guy in the world and a great friend of mine. And I emulated him without realizing, even though he said, forget show business is bad, but being around someone so funny all the time, I just naturally picked up his ways.
How did your father bill himself?
He billed himself as Lou Murphy, and then he had a partner named Buster, and they were known as Brenner and Buster, and their handle was Listen to the Two Bees Buzz.
He billed himself as Murphy?
Yeah, because there was a lot of prejudice against Jewish people.
So he took an Irish name?
Yeah, so they all, and he looked Irish. And in those days, all the Jewish actors and all the way through, like Kirk Douglas and everybody changed their name. All the Jewish people changed their name in order to be in the business. And my father did the same thing. Plus, my father's family was a prominent rabbinical family in Philadelphia. The Brenners were very prominent. My grandfather, Nathan Brenner, was a top rabbi, and Jay Gerson Brenner, my uncle, my father's brother, was a very prominent rabbi. And he didn't want the name of Brenner being used in show business, which is actually the reason why he left show business. He came back to Philadelphia. He had a contract to do movies in Hollywood. And he came back to see his family before doing the movies, and his father said, you know, you can't work on Shabbat on Friday night. You just can't. It's against the tradition of our people. You're violating thousands of years of tradition. And my father ripped up that Hollywood contract and never went back on the stage again. And he did live his whole life regretting, not that he didn't listen to his father, he wanted to listen to his father, regretting that he couldn't do what he really was meant to do, and that was be an entertainer.
Huh. So what did he do when he got out of entertainment?
He did a lot of odd jobs. He was worked for the Philadelphia Record, which was a newspaper here, and he was and he was with the Fairmount Park. He was in charge of the landscaping for Fairmount Park, and he was the manager of the Fairmount Park trolleys when they had him here. And then they went out of business. He was an insurance man, and then the main thing was he was a bookie. He was a numbers writer. That's the main. That was the mainstay of his income.
Did he have to do that on the Sabbath?
Yeah, he didn't take bets on Shabbat. Friday night, you can make a bet with Lou Brenner. But any other time, starting Saturday night, well, there were no numbers. I mean, Friday was over. There were no numbers on the weekend, see, so you didn't take bets on Friday night. You started taking bets again Sunday for the week. And he had a great talent. He could memorize all the bets without writing them down, so he could never get arrested. He had one shortcoming, though. He was a compulsive gambler with it, too. So when he would win, hit the numbers, he would play it back. Even though he was a bookie, he played it back with some other book, or his own book. He'd make bets. And he was a real Damon Runyon character. He was a wonderful, wonderful character.
So your father was a bookie. Now, you play Atlantic City and Vegas all the time, where you have all these compulsive gamblers coming to be entertained after they've either won or lost a lot of dough. Are there things you have to keep in mind when you're playing a room in Vegas or Atlantic City where you know a lot of the people have been gambling all day?
You have to keep it in mind, because it's very difficult to make someone laugh who just lost a lot of money.
Mm-hmm.
The big gamblers, it's easy to make them laugh. I always feel sorry for the small guy who lost the rent and all that. Well, he shouldn't be gambling. We all know that. But my father would sometimes lose the rent. I know what it's like to not have money because your father gambled it away. Gambling, like anything, you take it in moderation. I've controlled it. See, I have a compulsive, I have an addictive personality too. And so what I do is I play poker for very little money. I stay up all night, and it gives me a chance to, one, get the gambling part of my personality exhibited and out. And the other, it gives me a chance to talk to regular people, because after the first few hands, they're no longer playing poker with David Brenner. I'm now an adversary. I'm just another poker player. And we can talk, and then I can be with everyday people, which I really enjoy better than being with celebrities.
Your first career was actually producing television documentaries.
Right.
And you didn't start being a stand-up till you were about 28.
Yeah.
How exactly did you get from documentaries to comedy?
I went to this island, Nevis. It's becoming semi-popular now. It was absolutely abandoned then. I rented this little house. I think the house cost me $6 a day or something, and I stayed there for 2 weeks. And I listened to the news. I said, people got to laugh. So I came back, and I thought, well, instead of trying to make a career decision, I'll postpone it for a year. I had $9,000. I'll postpone that decision for a year. I'll live off the $9,000, and I'll get up and do stand-up comedy. Why not? And after a while, I thought, well, I should do one television show, at least to keep the record that I once did this. And I went on The Tonight Show.
Well, how'd you get on The Tonight Show?
I auditioned, a cold audition. I walked in a room with a bunch of people, and I got up on a stage. I did 8 minutes of jokes, and that was right before Christmas. And January 7th, I got a call in the evening. You want to go on tomorrow night? I said, sure. I went on January 8th, and boom, that was it. A whole new world.
Now, you've done The Tonight Show lots of times, not even counting the times that you guest hosted.
It'll be 100. My next appearance will be my 156th appearance.
So, would Carson put you at ease? I mean, what would he do to help you that you tried to pick up on your own show and when guesting his?
I noticed he did two things. One, he listened to his guests. And two, he tried to make his guests the best they could be rather than compete with them or put them down. And therefore, if it were an actor or a comedian, he'd make that comedian the funniest that comedian could be. Feed him so he could be. Or the actor, the most interesting and dramatic he could be. And at the end of the night, what I noticed the next day is people would say, did you see Carson? They all said, did you see Carson? Because Carson got the credit for it. He's smart. He made everybody the best they could be, which made him the best he could be. And I learned that from him and tried to do that in my own show, and also when I was sitting in for him or any other television host.
When you started doing comedy in, what, 68 or 69?
69. I started June of 69.
There weren't as many comics. It was before the comedy boom, before all the comedy clubs. And everybody had a niche, you know, like Robert Klein was the baby boom comic.
Yeah, the 50s, yeah. Steinberg was then. They were came before me, right? Steinberg, Richie Pryor, Cosby.
Yeah, Richie Pryor was like
they were the wave
young,
before
hip,
mine.
Black comic.
Yeah, right.
So where did you see yourself fitting in?
I didn't at all. I was really different, and I did what they call, now they tag it, it's observational comedy, and that is to look at anything and find humor in it. The most mundane, a friend of mine, Richard Lewis, said you have monopolized the obvious. You have a monopoly on the obvious, he said. And I thought that was a good way of describing my comedy. And I just got up there and did what I did on the street corner here at 60th and Osage Street. I just got up in front of Moe's candy store with my friends. I just got up and whatever happened. You know, car would go by, I'd make fun of car, person, boom, something would have, someone would say something, someone would say something dumb, and I, you know, like, let's run, you know, like, come on, let's run. And I said, yeah, you're still walking. I don't get it. You know, let's run. And they don't run. You know how people always say that? Come on, let's run. Let's run over there. And they walk, you know. And all that all came from the street corner. That all came from West Philadelphia and South Philadelphia before that. So I didn't think of any. I just thought I just do what I think is funny. And then they tagged it, observational comedy.
You had been a pretty regular sub for Carson.
Yes.
For a few years. Mm-hmm. When did you stop? Like, what were the reasons for stopping?
Well, I was the highest rated substitute host for about 3 years, up until about 82 or something. And what happened is they came down with a decision at NBC, which I thought was, in spite of the fact that it put me out of a job and it was my favorite job, was hosting the Tonight Show. They decided to have a permanent host. Now, even though I was the highest rated host, I was very much like Johnny. You know, we're both men. We both do, you know, clean, squeaky clean kind of material. He has more of a little pecs, bad boy, a devilish thing in it. I have a little devilish thing in me, but not as much as Johnny. Basically, we're both monologists and we do the monologues. Basically, we're similar. Even though he's from Nebraska and I'm from Philadelphia, there's some. So they wanted to get someone different that Johnny would be on and then this person would be on and we'd see the contrast and also get the new audience that Johnny doesn't have, maybe, because Johnny's audience was always my audience and all. And they chose to go with Joan Rivers. And I think it was a wise choice because that's exactly what they achieved. I mean, she was bombastic, little, big mouth, blonde, you know, and she was like a tank with blonde hair and a total contrast to Johnny. And so the show just exploded thanks to her and the contrast with Johnny. So the decision was right. However, I was out of a job and never went back because then I had my own show. At the time, they were looking for another permanent host, and they gave it to Gary Shandling and Jay Leno. Gary got his own show, Jay Leno is. And I haven't hosted this show in the last six years, something like that. I think 84 is when I, up to 84, something like that. And that was my favorite job. I go on with Johnny now as a guest, but I haven't hosted it. I would love to.
How often are you on now as a guest?
Well, see, it's different now, too. See, when I was doing, you could go on 8 to 10 times a year. That's how I got to go on 156 times. Now they really don't want anyone on more than every 3 months. So that limits you to 4 times. So now I don't have the avenues that I used to have. I can only be on Carson 4 times a year. And all the other talk shows, let's face it, talk shows, and there aren't that many, A. B, the talk shows aren't what they used to be. Now you have to be like a transvestite who eats dogs in order to get on a talk show.
You mean the morning shows?
Yeah, I mean all those talks. I mean, here we have women who hate men, who like to put needles in their face, and they ball with human heads. Today on Oprah. You know what I mean? I mean, what kind of shows are they? You know, and the public loves this. At least the ratings show the public loves this. What's David Brenner going to do? What does he do? He does, you know, family kind of humor. You know David Brenner. You know, he does funny stuff. He'll make anything. He can talk about any subject. Yeah, but today we have pigeon-toed, sadistic, you know, right-wing skinheads. I mean, what am I going to do on that show? So the avenues are closed to me. And so I'm seeking a side door as a re-entry into keeping the career alive. And that's why I've gotten involved in, beside my personal love for the sport, in billiards. And that's why I'm doing billiards. I get a lot of publicity in billiards. I wrote this book and possibly doing a pilot for an idea of a billiards show that I came up with that's very appealing to the public and anyone can play it. So I'm keeping active. I'm still working the way I was and not as much, I don't think. First it was from choice, and now I think it's a matter of getting back and pushing those avenues that opened to me that used to be, I had so many. I'm in the book of lists, having appeared as a guest on more talk shows than any other entertainer in the history of television. That's because the shows were there for me to get on, and I change my material all the time. I never repeat things. So I'm sure a side door is going to be the way back in.
What about the clubs and, you know, in the big rooms?
Well, the problem there, you see, is there's a dearth of big rooms and clubs. You have to be the comedy stores, which are wonderful because they gave all these young men and young women an opportunity to go into the career, even though I think that comedy has become, it's almost like it's, I can see, I have this image of people sitting around in a dorm and saying, well, you know, I just finished my freshman year of liberal arts. I got to take I was thinking of pre-law or pre-med or comedy. It's like a field now. It's like anyone can choose it. Well, what do you think? Yeah, maybe I could do comedy too. Yeah. And a guy's never told a joke, or a woman's never, but they can do it. And it's like a lightweight kind of puffy I'm not putting it down in the sense that I'm you know, like jaded and sour grapes. Look, I got my townhouse and my money's in the bank and I've been a star for 17 years. It's not that, and still do my work. It's just that it's very puffy. And so now, but the public has a choice. They can go see 7 or 8 new comedians, 4 of which will be really good. 2 are okay and 2 are terrible, but they'll still have a good evening for this price. Or they can go see David Brenner, who they've seen 2-3 times, you know, like in this area, Valley Forge in Philadelphia or in Vegas or whatever. So let's go see the new comedians. So what happened with all these comedy clubs and people being saturated with comedy is that's what's happened. They've been satiated to the point where they don't go out to see. Now, if these clubs die off and there's a tendency to think that the comedy boom has boomed, then they may return to say, let's go see those few, you know, Lily Tomlin and Richie Pryor, not that they're not doing business, and Bill Cosby and David Brenner and Steve Landisberg, you know. Let's go back to our staple ones, you know, the reliable, the guys who are going to make us laugh, definitely make us laugh tonight. So I think there's a big change coming in comedy again.
Does it still feel great to get laughs, having gotten them for so long?
My father, when I was a little boy, even though he discouraged me from show business, he said to me, he said, Kingy, there is no greater feeling in the whole world than standing on a stage and hearing 1,000 people laugh at you. And I want to tell you, he said, if you make one person a day have a good belly laugh, then your life has been really worthwhile on this earth. And my father lived by that rule, and I've tried to live by the rule, because one of the sweetest sounds in the world is a genuine, honest laugh from someone.
What about bombing, though? Do you still bomb?
No, I don't bomb anymore, thank goodness. Not that I may not end up bombing. I have shows that aren't as good as other shows that are off. I'm off. But in the beginning, I bombed worse than anybody. They used to say, you know, oh, I bombed. They had an expression, I'm in a commode. It was in a commode. And I used to say, forget, I was like through the sewage system. I was out in the ocean. I was at the bottom. Whales were above where my bombs were. I was the worst bomber in the world for the first 3 months. My first night, I was really good. And after that, I was so scared. That I was doing an impression of myself in the first night. But I bombed horribly, but I haven't bombed in years because, you know, you're a household. I saw Bill Cosby when I was starting out. Cosby got up on a stage and said hello, and the audience laughed. And I said, see, that's when you know you've arrived, when you can just say hello. And one time when my career was just getting hot and I came out and said, hey, how you doing? And the audience laughed. I knew I had arrived.
David Brenner. He'll be appearing in Lake Tahoe New Year's Eve.